Sexton trying to get loose. He'll fire. He knocks it down.
But Carl slammed it home.
Garland upstairs. Oh!
Sexton inside. Oh. A thunderous dunk. And Allen blocked the shot at the rim.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Cavs media family. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. The Cleveland Cavaliers have been eliminated from playoff contention. And with that in mind, we shift our focus to analyzing the season that was, the players that we anticipate being part of the Cavs' future, and some of the possible additions they might be making through the NBA draft. With me today to discuss this is my co-host, Carter Rodriguez. Carter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well, man. The Cavs had a really, really fun one against Phoenix and then a not so fun one against Portland. But, you know, that is this season in a nutshell. I can't get worked up at this stage of the season about just about anything other than fun stuff. Cause like, what's the point? Mm-hmm. They've been eliminated. So really I'm just looking for stuff to get excited about. I'm not really looking to get too worked up about anything. Which is good because they're losing a whole lot right now.
They are. And Cavs Twitter is losing their collective minds. An OT loss with Isaac Okoro getting his career high is something that I found very enjoyable. I don't root for Cavs losses, but I understand that they're probably not the worst thing in the world right now. But this isn't all about us, is it, Carter? We have a very special...
It often isn't.
That's very true. We just like to make it a little bit about ourselves. We're self-involved in that way. But we have a very special guest today from Dime Up Rocks, the analyst, Liberty Ballers, and my favorite moment of the NBA season during a Doc Rivers press conference, Jackson Frank. Jackson, how you doing?
Doing well. How are the two of you today?
Not too bad, man. I took the day off. It was lovely. It's my brother's birthday. We're pretty much in lockdown now, but golf is allowed. So I got to have a little
bit
of a deal.
How's Jules doing?
He's doing well. He was doing very well. It was nice to get some fresh air. A little colder than I would have liked, but you know what? We still got it in. As Carter mentioned, you had done some really, really good pieces recently on the Cavs. And
yeah, Jackson, just so you know, like the getting picked up by the team is a one-time thing, I think.
we don't very often get people telling us that we need to book a guest. And we had a lot of mentions, both with your Isaac Okoro feature, which was at Dime Up Rocks, as well as your recent feature this week with the analyst on Darius Garland. And we'll start off with the Garland feature. And the question that I was wondering is, were you always high on Darius Garland, or is this something that's progressively grown as he's improved throughout his career?
Yeah, I think I was probably middle of the road on him as a prospect. He was the first class where I really did a bunch of in-depth work. I think I had him 10th or 11th. So I don't think I was super high. I definitely was not super high. I know some people on draft Twitter had him 3rd, 4th, 5th, kind of anywhere in there. So I would say I was pretty middle of the road on him. But watching last year, I know it was a tough season for him last year. But you saw the outlines at times. If you're able to catch enough games of maybe he could, if you could figure out the scoring part of it, he would be pretty interesting. And he's definitely taken a step forward as a scorer and as a decision maker in general this year. So this season, kind of from the outset, even dating back to the preseason, was when I really felt like I was like, okay, this dude has something here when the Cavs have something with this point guard.
Yeah, it was funny because last season, obviously coming off the two surgeries, there was kind of a thought that, hey, maybe he might not be fully healthy, but those flashes were there. The thing that always impressed me last year was that he made some really good reads as a passer. And coming in, there was some of the analysis that I said read kind of pointed towards him making good reads, but this is still kind of a questionable part of his career. And when I saw him make kind of the advanced reads that he was making as a rookie at times, my thought was, hey, if the athleticism comes back, if he's able to shoot, it almost reminded me of Jamal Murray in his rookie year where he wasn't fully healthy. And I assume that he's going to be a good shooter. And if that is kind of a known commodity, it's going to open up the rest of his game. Was it the passing for you that kind of gave you reason to believe that there might be another tier for him?
Last year, for sure, yeah. And I was someone as a prospect, I definitely wasn't super high on his passing. Again, it was tough to know much because he only played 4.5 games or whatever, and they were all against, I think, for the most part, not great opponents. I think all of them were
with not great teammates.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and I don't think he played for some big time, you know, AAU or high school team. So finding pre-college stuff wasn't super easy. But last year, yeah, definitely, it was the passing that kind of, you know, hooked me in initially to say, hey, if we can figure it out as a scorer, then there's there's a lot here because, as you mentioned, I mean, once the scoring comes and you already got the passing, it's always easier for those things to kind of work off of each other and kind of exponentially grow your entire offensive game.
Yeah, this whole season we kind of liked what we were seeing, and then he kind of took a leap before turning his ankle. And I kind of before had just completely ascribed it to, he's just got to shoot more threes. He's got to shoot more threes. And I think you did a nice job of kind of calling out that that was kind of a weakness in his game. Like, what do you think the volume shooting has really opened up for him?
Yeah, I mean, so what he's had basically all year, I think, is he's had the threat of the jumper, right? You know, teams guard him out there. He's got kind of a good shot, big open driving lanes with it. But, I mean, just the fact that he's at 39, I want to say 39.4, 39, hovering right around 40 this year from three, like, just shooting more of those rather than those long twos, because I'm not, you know, I don't want to just, you know, break it down to, like, the analytics side of things and, like, mid-range jumpers are bad. But for Garland, they aren't great because he struggles to get them off because he's a smaller guy, right? He's not even Steph's size. And I mean, Steph is an average size guard. And again, that's not me comparing to Steph, but he just struggles to kind of get those shots off because he's small. And so when you can play behind the arc, you just have kind of more freedom to your game, more room. Obviously, you know, you look at guys like Dame and Steph and Harden, even kind of guys who expand the range, like you just have more opportunities back there. So I think it just improves his efficiency a lot. Like, I think as a passer, I already believe in him, his passing being good enough to drive a high level offense, but it was getting the scoring to where it needed to be. I think he's up to 55 or 50, high 54 true shooting, still below league average, much better than last year, even a step up from where he was before the All-Star break. So it just allows him to get to a point where he can be a 20, 23 point per game scorer. And if he can kind of continue to improve as a 2-point scorer, I don't want to set super high bar for him as, you know, in terms of scoring efficiency, but I think it gets him to a point where he's good enough to really drive a good offense or even a very good offense if the requisite, you know, complementary pieces are around him.
You know, it's funny, between Garland and Sexton, I feel like maybe less analytically inclined Cavs fans have gotten a true lesson in just how hard it is to be efficient, even if you're slashing good numbers, if the shot diet is wrong. I mean, and you're not getting to the line. I think that was a huge problem with Sexton early in his career, and I think he's actually really done a great job of remedying that. He's gotten a lot better getting to the line, and obviously is shooting a little bit more threes. Garland was the same way. I mean, the 2-point percentage was meh, but the 3-point percentage was good, and the free throw percentage was good, and it didn't matter because he was taking too high of a percentage of his shots for those, you know, those long twos, those floaters. And yeah, I just feel like it really does kind of, it is an exercise in shot diet more than anything else, because it's not an exercise in skill, because we knew he had the skill.
Yeah. And what you're seeing even since the All-Star break, which I think I included in my piece, is he's kind of learning that it's okay if that big man, you know, swats the heck out of your ball a couple of times, because even if I shoot 56% at the rim, it's really hard to shoot 50% or whatever on floaters. Even if I feel more comfortable with them, like, I kind of got to step outside my comfort zone and be okay with, you know, with Rudy Gobert or Joel Embiid or Nerlens Noel, whoever it is, you know, swatting my shot to the fourth row. Like, that's okay. Like, if that happens once or twice a game, but I also go 3-for-4 on every other attempt I get off cleanly, that's a better percentage than, you know, trying those long floaters from the elbow or whatever it is and avoiding contact altogether. And who knows, maybe they throw out their other arm and they get me in the chest and I draw a foul if they block the shot properly. So I think you've seen a concerted effort to at least maybe not just get into the paint and get a shot, but get a good shot in the paint. I think, I don't know what the numbers are specifically, but he's definitely had an uptick on shots at the rim versus shots kind of in that the NBA classifies them as a very, I think they call them like non-restricted area inside the paint, which is such an unpleasant way to try and phrase that. But there's not a better way, I guess, just paint twos outside away from the rim, I guess, is maybe the concise way to frame it. But you're seeing him make a concerted effort to maybe take a couple more dribbles and do that, and that's huge. I mean, the shots at the rim are the easiest ones to get, the highest percentage, and even if it's maybe if you get embarrassed a couple of times and someone pins your shot against the backboard, it's going to help your team overall. If you can, you know, no one's going to block your shot every time.
And also frankly, like, it's not just the free, it's not just the finishing, it's getting the line a little bit more. Like, Justin has talked a lot about how Garland can shy away from contact, and that's part of the other downside of the floater is it's almost never anything but a shot attempt. Like, you're not going to get fouled on a lot of floaters.
Yeah, that's for sure. But yeah, I think his free throw rate is, you know, the numbers, I think I want to say it was like, he's up to like, I think a 20% free throw rate ever, which is still not, I mean, it's nowhere near like, you want to, I think generally speaking, like for stars, you want to maybe be at 28 to 30% is kind of the low end. Obviously guys like Giannis and Embiid, Harden are up there higher, but I think if you can kind of get to the 28 to 30% range, paired with how good we think Garland can be as a shooter, you're in a pretty good spot in terms of, you know, producing efficient scoring numbers for yourself.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the point you're making about making sure you're taking those right shots, even if it does lead to blocks, I think that's so important for young players to kind of test out what those limits are, right? Like even turnovers, when you talk about a young lead guard, I don't want them to necessarily be risk adverse at this stage of their career, right? You want to figure out exactly what you're able to get away with. And when you're a crafty player like Darius Garland, when you get to the rim, you're going to learn things from every single possession. You get more usable game film going into the offseason of, okay, I need to work on this aspect of my game because when I'm getting to the rim, this is what I'm seeing. This is what I need to be able to do. When you're looking at the next steps for Darius Garland, do you think in order for him to take a leap next season, it is something that he needs to develop from a skill set standpoint, or is it a decision-making thing with him where, yeah, get to the rim more, take more threes? What do you think is kind of the most important thing to him for him to focus on this offseason?
I think it's just continuing to prioritize the right shots in his diet and just a shot making consistency thing, which I think generally comes with age. Taking a few more threes, I think, would be huge. I don't know exactly what his 3-point rate, I think, is a little lower than last year, but it's coming at the expense of taking more shots to the rim, more or less, I think, which is an encouraging thing. That's right. Not bad, but just getting rid of those, so many of those long twos and those floaters were like I get the floater is an important weapon, like very, very clearly. I'm not trying to get rid of that shot at all. I think it's a super awesome skill to have as an intermediate game. But there'll be so many times we'll get in the lane, especially earlier last season than earlier this year, where he gets in the lane and that's kind of his first choice, where he just will take a wide open floater when he's got 2 or 3 feet of runway there.
Yeah,
so taking some more threes.
There was a tweet from a member of Cavs Twitter. I've referenced it on the pod before, but I love it. And it was like, Cavs are down double digits. Time to take some runners. And like that is kind of their break glass in case of emergency. Like, we're not getting good shots. Screw it. We're taking floaters. And it never works out well.
Yeah. And the thing is also, it's like important to remember I try to always view these people as, you know, view them as people, right? It's not fun to have your shot blocked. It's not fun to try and go finish over Rudy Gobert or around Rudy Gobert. Like, those are unpleasant things to do. I know obviously NBA players are much different than me, but I always think it's funny that I will, when I write about players, I'll be quick to maybe talk about their contact aversion, then I'll go play pick up basketball and I won't go within 4 feet of the rim because I don't want to worry about that stuff. That's just kind of the thing that takes time, because Garland is small and he's just, he's slight of frame. He can get to the rim, but you know, it just is something that you got to kind of learn to live with. And that's not an easy thing. That's easy for me to say it, right? And so like learn to live with getting your shot blocked twice a game. Like, come on, it'll help your efficiency. It's a lot harder to put in practice. So I think just kind of continuing to grow in terms of understanding what are the best shots and how the fact that he can kind of get a shot from wherever he wants, more or less, you know, not always going to be great high efficiency shots for him, but wherever he wants to get, he can kind of get there on the court with his burst and his shiftiness and his ball handling. So, kind of continuing to expand his range from deep, and then also try and get to the rim more and draw fouls or finish there. So I don't think he really has to, like, I think he will improve as a finisher. That's just kind of what happens as you get bigger. You look at a guy like Damian Lillard, who people have comped him a lot to at times. Dame isn't a great finisher, but he's much better than he was his first couple of years. He's a lot stronger too. So I think that's just kind of the thing. Once he gets more confident in his strength and his body, you know, finishing, driving to the rim more, but also just like letting it fly from deep more, either it's on the ball, off the ball. There's times I think still where he's a little too gun shy and he'll get an open three and he'll kind of dribble into something else. So just the kind of things that I think you tend to notice and pick up when you have a entire offseason to watch film and review everything. So the fact that you've already seen some improvements in season, I think is really, really encouraging for him, but I think you could see an even bigger step in the next couple of years as he kind of sees each offseason, what happens in games.
So, you know, I think one thing that any good, you know, analysis piece, sorry, I can't talk. Any good analysis piece is able to put something into words that you, the viewer, might not have always been able to put into words. And it's funny because we spend a lot of time talking about Garland's frame. I think analysts spend a lot of time talking about Garland's frame. It's almost always specifically regarding the defensive end. One thing I thought was really great in the piece was talking about the fact that one spot where Garland being a little bit smaller, being a little bit slighter, really hurts him is passing out, driving and kicking, as opposed to dumping off to big men on the interior. Can you speak to that a little bit more? Because I thought it was a really, really smart point.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think so. He just, like, he can make the live dribble skip pass with either hand. You've seen it a number of times this year from the inside of the out. But it's just tougher if you can't directly see when you're driving, because I mean, he collapses defenses so well, partly because the Cavs floor spacing is pretty bad for them. I mean, they have some shooters, but, you know, both in terms of volume and success rate from three, they're near the bottom of the league. And so teams kind of know they can sell out there, in conjunction with the fact that if we sell out, you know, Garland's just kind of small. You can't necessarily get him around. Like, a lot of times, like, length is such a huge part of, you know, just being able to get that one little inch you need to wrap a pass around a guy and things like that. So whereas his size helps him because he can get to these spots in the paint with a small frame and make the pass to Allen or the dump off to Nance or, you know, hitting the cutting to Coro. He just isn't quite able to do the same thing from the inside out. But I am kind of like tepid on that, because I would like to see how that looks when he has better spacing around him. You know, I think I cited some number that he's pretty low in terms of threes assisted on. But is that more of something that it's a deficiency for him, or is it that the fact that he's playing with a lot of guys who don't shoot from three very often, and one of his best shooters like Kevin Love has missed most of the year, the last couple of seasons. So, just the fact that he doesn't have the length or the vision or the size to see over the top or around guys or make passes around them is kind of a detriment to him, but at the same time, it helps him kind of make those lobs and whatnot too.
I think that in a lot of ways, it is also literally, he's not strong enough to put zip on the passes when he does have to do the wraparound. You know, you'll look at some of the passes he'll make where it's the right read, but it gets deflected because he gets it on target, but it's not coming in hot enough, and defenders can recover. You know, I don't know if that's something that's going to get much better in terms of getting the zip. I always like to talk about passing as being, people treat passing as one skill, but I really think it's two skills. It's ability to see it and then ability to make it. I actually really like learned that split watching Andre Drummond, because Andre Drummond actually can make really great passes, just doesn't see them often enough. And you know, there's players who are the inverse. And I think sometimes Garland's like that on the, you know, on these kickouts. I do think getting stronger and just getting older, getting man strength, because I still think he's got his frame. Just,
it's so funny that
looks
he added 17 pounds coming into this season and he's still slight, right? Like,
and he might just always be slight, but I still think he can get a little bit more development. I don't know, Justin, do you think that's something that he can like get to in terms of getting enough zip on those kickouts?
I think so. I think that that's something that can improve, because you do see him do it with either hand, as Jackson pointed out, and it's, I think as he adds some strength, it's going to help, but maybe it's just not going to be his primary strength, right? Like, maybe when there is more spacing and things open up, those passing lanes become more obvious, but there are times when it is congested, right? There's times where you're prioritizing the development of guys that don't necessarily help with the spacing, which, I mean, Isaac Okoro is a prime example of that, where you want to get him starters minutes because of what he's showing on the defensive end and what he brings to the table. But at the same time, that does make it a little more difficult for Garland and Sexton and other guys, especially when Love is out. Moving on to Okoro, Jackson, for our listeners, make sure you're checking out the piece that Jackson did at Dime Up Rocks on Isaac Okoro. I want to ask the same question that I asked for Garland in terms of what skill he should prioritize going into this offseason, because he's another guy that's improved throughout this season, and that's really encouraging. Everything you hear about him is he's another one of those really, really high work ethic guys that's made leaps every year of his career kind of thing. What would you prioritize if you were working with him this offseason in order for him to improve next year?
Yeah, so I think the three main things that maybe I even touched on in the article would one be continue to improve his ball handling. He took a step, pretty sizable step forward between high school and his 1 year at Auburn there. Like, he has a couple of moves he can do, but still it's a huge step up to the league where it hasn't quite worked as well. And that's, you see these flashes where he runs a pick and roll or he attacks, you know, off the catch, but he's kind of limited there because of the handles to an extent. Two would be, I mean, obvious, it seems obvious, but the three ball, whatever it is, I mean, because I do think his form is a little better than it was at Auburn, which is encouraging. It's another sign of his year-to-year growth, which is cool to see. That's one of the benefits of watching these guys for a few years. You can kind of identify those areas of growth. But getting even more comfortable, further streamlining his release. I think he's a little quicker getting the ball out of his hands, but part of the reason I think teams ignore him, even though he's not – like, I don't think his numbers are – they're not good, but they're not, like, awful, I don't think, from three. I think maybe right around 31, 32.
Yeah, and it's like 40% at home for whatever reason. Like, it's the weirdest splits.
But just continue to get – I think part of the reason teams can sag off him is because he doesn't have a super quick release. So I think continuing to improve that part of it. And then three, more – like, finding some way to get more flexible. Because I talked about that in my article a little bit. Like, he feels kind of so tightly contained almost a little bit, which I think hurts more on the rim because he was a really excellent finisher in college and it hasn't translated this year. And that's part of the reason his efficiency as a scorer isn't very good right now. So I think figuring out ways to kind of finish around guys rather than always through them, I think would be huge for him. So obviously I think the last one is a kind of a fairly nuanced thing and not necessarily super elite, super easily achievable. Some guys are just flexible and others aren't, but I think there are pathways to all three things improving. And and then maybe the fourth part would just be to continue just watch back all the film of the guys he guarded this year. And because I talked about that in my piece too, is he doesn't quite have the proactive nature in terms of understanding guys' tendencies yet, which makes sense. I mean, you just aren't going to learn that, especially in your rookie year. But figuring out ways to shut off what guys want to do rather than just say attach to them while they do what they want to do, because most guys, if you can't prevent them from shooting, they're just going to, you know, they're in their rhythm, right? Like, I mean, most of the superstar offensive players are tough shot makers. And so there's only so much you can do if you don't know how to cut off what they want to do.
Yeah, I think, was it you that actually tweeted the bit about how Danny Green has been mentoring Dybul on mm-hmm. on Philly? And,
yeah.
You know, it's good to know that, like, it's very, very, I mean, it's obvious when you think about it, but even someone like Dybul, who is already a super gifted defender, is picking up a ton from these veterans who just know these tendencies mm-hmm. and have guarded these guys for year after year after year. Because so many times, Okoro does play pretty fundamental defense. Like, I think I very rarely am like, oh, yeah, he really screwed up there. But, like, guys get him with tricks and with the stuff they're really, really special at. And that does come with time.
Yeah, and that's something that Matisse has talked about even. So someone asked maybe a couple months ago that, you know, like, do you feel at all like if you've improved your on-ball defense, you know, from his rookie year, which he certainly has as someone who's watched in both years. And he said, he kind of like said, maybe if he has at all, it's just related to knowing guys' tendencies. And that's something that I'd thought about to an extent, but as I kind of listened to that and I wrote a piece about Matisse as well, and also wrote this thing about Okoro, it kind of further entered my brain, something that's really important and maybe kind of allowed me to realize, like, wow, whenever I watch Okoro, as you mentioned, it's like, he's playing good defense, but he gets scored on so much. Like, what is it about that? And so
can you guys hear me still?
Yeah. I think you lost your AirPods, but you just picked up elsewhere.
They're on the Fritz. I need some new ones.
I'm telling you, AirPods are just a dangerous game. I feel like you, cause they don't like really let you know when you're close until it's way too late.
Yeah. I didn't know until somebody popped on my screen there when they were done. But for anything I was saying, it's just like, you know, you can say a lot of times with young guys, right? Like, oh, they'll just improve this weakness once they get more time in the league. But I think for defensive stoppers, guys who play a lot of tough on-ball assignments, that really is the case. Like, Okoro gets it. Like, he knows how to stay in front of guys. He's awesome navigating screens for a guy who's as compact as he is. But just figuring out, hey, like, this guy, if he hesitates here, he's going to go to a crossover to his left. Like, knowing how to kind of cut that off is just something that you learn with time and watching film. And so that's something I'm really encouraged by. I think just next year he's going to be an even better on-ball defender, and some of those matchup stats that don't look great for him right now are going to look a lot better next year with the same assignments.
I really like the anecdote of Danny Green helping out Thibel. Like, maybe that's something that the Cavs could look into it as they look to fill out this roster. I don't think there's a high likelihood that they're going to have tons of cap space, but they are going to have options in free agency, and maybe getting a defensive stopper or a veteran that has experience in the league to help mentor him, because he's coming into a situation where It's not like there was a veteran option to kind of really show him the ropes and to point things out. Like this is a team that was near dead last in defensive rating for the last couple of years. And the fact that he's been able to step up as a rookie is really great. But hey, there's a lot of veterans out there that have wisdom to dispel. So you don't want to lose recipes, right? Like you got to pass this stuff along.
Yeah. I mean, hey, Danny Green's a free agent this offseason. The Sixers have his bird rights, but hey, maybe he wants to make a return to where it all started.
Absolutely. Yeah, hey, the Cavs are in the business of bringing back old members of the franchise. So you never know.
He'd be instantly their best floor spacer too. So maybe there's something there. We'll see.
Hey, yeah, kill two birds with one stone. That's always a good thing when you're looking to round out a rotation. One question I do love to ask anytime that we have a guest that has done research on the Cavs young guys is how you would rank kind of the core young four guys of Garland, Sexton, Okoro, and Allen in terms of upside. If you were doing an evaluation of them, how would you kind of break those down?
Yeah, so I think if I'm going kind of ceiling outcome, Garland definitely first. Then I think I would go Okoro versus Sexton. I think is really interesting to me. I think I think Sexton has the floor argument, right? Because he's already a pretty solid player with his scoring and his ability to work on and off the ball like that. He's already got a very, very high level NBA skill, but in versatile scoring, which encapsulates a lot of specific skills on their own. But in Okoro, you're looking at a guy who might. You know, I tweeted out that joking Spider-Man meme of Jimmy Butler and Okoro, and I don't think he's ever going to get that good. But you're looking at kind of a similar archetype, right, of a guy who can play a lot of different positions defensively, but also run some pick and rolls and attack the rim and finish there. And you haven't seen a ton of passing from Okoro this year, but you've seen some, and you saw a lot of that in high school and college. So there's something there. So I think I would go Okoro in terms of like peak outcome, but I see the argument for Sexton if he can continue to improve, kind of working off of his scoring gravity with his playmaking and whatnot. And then I would go Allen last, but that is not like that's not by any means an indictment on Allen. I think there's just, unless he really takes a leap as a shooter, which might happen, but I don't think you see a ton of indicators there. But you're looking at a guy who's a very good pick and roll defender, one of the best play finishers in the league, worked really well with Garland especially. So that's where I would go, but I think that's a pretty interesting and intriguing core four. I think the fact that Allen, who you can make a case is their best player. I don't know if you necessarily would make it, but you have a case for it. The fact that he's fourth and he's still on his rookie contract is a testament. Like, they've got some stuff here. I don't know if they have everything right now, but they've got some pretty interesting guys who I think can really carve out a niche in this league and be useful in maybe high end starters or all stars.
Yeah, and the more of those guys you develop, the better. Like, the thing I really like is that they do fit well together. Like, Garland, Sexton, and Okoro, obviously, you'd like Okoro to have a better outside shot at this time to kind of open up things for those guys. But, like, from a production standpoint, that's the best Cavs combination that they've had. Like, even the defensive kind of shortcomings of the Garland-Sexton duo are outperforming maybe your better defensive option of going with Garland, Okoro, and Taurean Prince for the year. They have a better defensive rating. So that's a positive to me. Sexton,
if I can jump in here real quick, I do kind of want to ask Jackson, like, when you look at that kind of core four, I think we mostly all would agree that those four players are all trending up pretty well. Like, Sexton's gotten better every year. Garland's gotten better every year. Allen's obviously a very promising young player, and Okoro has definitely shown some real promise and definitely is a favorite of yours. They're still losing a lot of games. You know, what would you say to Cavs fans who might be saying, well, yeah, I don't if everyone's so great, why are we, you know, losing 10 games in a row, 12 games in a row? As often as we are, kind of what is your reaction to that?
So one, I think the biggest thing is Garland, I think, is going to be a very, very good offensive engine in 2 or 3 years. He's not there yet. He's just not. We talked about the scoring efficiency. As much as true shooting requires context, a guy who, if your lead guard is averaging 18 a game on 54.7% true shooting, and he's commanding leading most of the touches on the court, you're going to struggle. Like, that's just the way it is. You talk about Okoro. If I'm ranking as your second best guy, he's not very good right now. He just isn't. Like, he plays good defense, but he also gets beat. He gets beat a lot in the sense that guys score. I'm not beat in terms of, you mentioned, Carl, like, not getting blown by and totally out of the play, but a lot of times the best players, you know, figure it out against him. Sexton, I think, you know, for as good as he's been offensively as a scorer, I think he still has a long way to go defensively, particularly off the ball. Allen, I don't really think Allen is to blame. I think Allen has been wonderful. That's
he's
not
really good. He's such a high floor player. Like,
he's already a very good player. So I don't really want to bring him into it, but I think beyond that, I think like their offense is just very bland. I think Bickerstaff's done a pretty decent job defensively in some ways, but the offense, like so often I'll watch them play and it's like, okay, they'll run one or one and a half actions. And then boom, it's Garland or Sexton dribbling around trying to figure out like, hey, let's run into a pick and roll. And there's 8 seconds left. So I think whether it's Bickerstaff improving as a schematic coach or bringing someone in who is more experienced or more just a better offensive mind there, I think that would help a lot because they've got a lot of talent, I think, honestly, offensively, like enough to be better than where they are. Not saying they're going to be fourth or fifth or eighth or whatever, but enough to be 17th or 20th or 18th. What are they now? Like they're right around the bottom, I want to say.
They're not dead last anymore, I don't think, but they were for a long stretch of the season. I do think like it is, you know, and there's a chicken and the egg question there, in my opinion, because it's like, yes, the system is not super diverse in its nature. As you said, it could be a little bland. Also, they're young and don't have an excess of great decision makers, especially with their power forwards being banged up as often as they've been. Because those are two of the best,
which is exactly
minds
was,
on the team.
Yeah, because we kind of wrote about in my piece, right? Is that like, you know, they just need someone else who is a sound decision maker who can also kind of dribble, which is not. I mean, Nance and Love, you can do a lot of stuff from the elbows and the post, but you don't really want them dribbling up top and making decisions there, right? So, and even as you've mentioned, Carter, they're not available enough as you'd like to do that. So that's part of it too. They feel like one guy who projects as a pretty good offensive player away from kind of unlocking everything. I think Garland can be a really awesome player on the ball and he's shown flashes of that, but he's also very good off the ball with the off movement shooting and whatnot. Sexton, obviously with his increased cutting and his burst and all that, can release some stuff off the ball. Okoro is an awesome cutter already. So I think you're kind of one knot, to tying everything together to being at least a salvageable offense rather than one that is, you know, you have to caveat with they're not the worst defense anymore or worst offense anymore.
Right.
So I think they might be able to get that soon since they're, you know, as Justin mentioned, they're out of the playoff race now. So I think they're at least in a path and a spot to where they can find that guy.
Well, the nice thing is there was some proof of concept. Like Kevin Love hasn't shot well since he's come back. You can tell he's not 100%, but since he came back, the offensive rating is up by around 110. Every single one of the kind of core four guys has a true shooting percentage since April started of over 58%, which is great, right? Like you have a little bit of proof of concept that, hey, you get a floor spacer there, whether it's Kevin Love or someone else, that might open things up for them. But again, so much of this is doing that consistently. Like Garland, his high water marks may become more frequent, but as you mentioned, it may take another year or two before he's running a high-level offense at a consistent level. You just hope that those good games become more and more frequent. And as you mentioned, there is a draft upcoming with... It's an exciting draft for me because not only should the Cavs have a top eight pick, there seems to be really good options throughout the top 10 for them, guys that really fit. I'd like to get your breakdown, though, of kind of how you would break out the first couple tiers of this draft, who you have in them, and maybe some elaboration of why you have those guys in those particular tiers.
Yeah, so I think, you know, at the top, you got to start with Cade. You know, he's wonderful. He's kind of the next in line of these bigger, you know, offensive initiators, but he's also a very, very good defender on and off the ball, super technically sound. Any team that gets him is going to, their core is going to be completely infused with a guy. But obviously, you know, with a team like Cleveland, who, as we mentioned, has some stability in place there, but maybe needs kind of the guy. Because I think as good as Garland can be offensively, I think the defense might always prevent him from being the guy on a team that can win a playoff series or so.
Sorry to cut you off there, but I think that's true of almost every guard. Like, I think it's really hard to win a championship when a point guard is your best player. Like, it's just, it's a wing-driven league, and front court players impact the team defense at a higher level than a guard ever could. So maybe Garland might be able to become a good positional defender, and you have enough infrastructure behind him. But I completely agree with you. Like, as much as I think Garland is someone to build around and a cornerstone piece, I don't think he necessarily can be the guy.
Yeah, and I think even if you don't want to make the litmus test to win a title, you look at it, you know, like the Blazers, like they more often than not, they aren't winning a playoff series every year. And that's not an indictment on Dame or anything like that. It's just, as you mentioned, it's tough when your best player is kind of poor defensively. Like it just puts a ceiling on things. But Cade would be my first guy. And then kind of I've gone back and forth a lot, but like 1B, 2A tier would be Evan Mobley. He's really, really awesome. I don't think he's quite as good as Cade, but a really versatile two-way big man who I think would be wonderful for this team. He's certainly a guy who could make decisions on the perimeter. He's a really, really good passer, has a great handle for his size.
There are a lot of people who feel he's really a center, not a power forward. What are your thoughts on that?
There's not a lot of people who feel he's a center, or there are.
I get a lot of people saying, well, he's big, he's going to end up being a center, so it's kind of a bit conflicting with Jared Allen. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't think it's an issue. He's really, really mobile. He covers so much ground. He can play the four, I think. Like, he is a guy who, and I think especially if the jumper comes around, I don't think he's going to be some huge shooter, but he uses space really well offensively too. Like, guys will sag off of him and he'll just take one or two dribbles and get into his rhythm, pull up jumper, or he'll attack the rim. But again, his mobility and his length combination are really, really special on defense, to the point where you want to play him at the four, like, that's totally fine. Like, either he gets beat and you funnel him to Allen, who's an excellent rim protector, or he just shuts off whatever's going on there. So
this is my take, by the way. I don't understand. You know, this is very clearly to me, if you're looking for a model, it's kind of AD on the Lakers when they play with a traditional five, which is great back line, whoever you got back there. If it's Allen guarding at the point of attack, or it's Mobley, whoever's not guarding at the point of the attack is lurking to clean up whatever happens on the back end.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, people have made some of the AD comps. I wasn't doing draft stuff, and I was probably a little bit too young to even be that smart at basketball back then. There are some AD comps in the length and the mobility and kind of the frame. Obviously, AD's put on a lot of strength since he's been in the league, but he was a pretty skinny dude. You go look at him back in Kentucky, that dude was he was slight of frame. So I think that's certainly a good comp there, and it makes sense. So I would go that's my top two. Three, I know people like Jalen Suggs. He's an excellent prospect, but I would go Jalen Green for the Cavs specifically. And I think I would probably go Jalen Green in most cases. The strides he's made, between what you saw in high school and AAU and then during the G League Ignite season, just a really, really explosive scorer, is learning how to kind of make, he's kind of like Sexton in the sense that he's a score first guy, but he's already taken a step forward and learning how to create for others off of that. Still pretty inconsistent on defense, but 6'5", really, really good athlete, really skilled scorer, can get to the rim, create advantages. And someone who can create off the bounce with size would be a welcomed addition for the Cavs, obviously. Mm-hmm. So that would be
those off-ball lobs, like the off-ball lobs that, like, I can just picture Garland kind of probing and having Allen in the dunker spot. You got Jalen Green being so active off-ball. Like, it's not hard to sell me on him as a prospect at all.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even, I mean, again, I know there are people who really like Sexton and people who really don't. I consider myself in the middle, but I don't think, like, it would be a bad thing if Sexton, you know, was your third best guard, right? I think there's that, like, allowing him to kind of maybe be the second decision maker on any lineup, whether it's if it's Jalen Green and Darius Garland is kind of your two guys, like, let him just hone in on the scoring part of attacking, you know, running the pick and roll every now and then, but running second side actions and attacking off the catch, cutting when someone else is doing something. He would really kick butt there. So again, that's just a testament to kind of what I think he can do, and more the fact that I think Garland is their best guy, you know, long term. And it's just really tough, you know, if you want to take it back to Portland again, it's just really tough to build around two undersized guards, let alone ones that are even smaller than Dame and CJ. So I think Jalen Green would be awesome for them. But then even if you used to mention top eight, you got guys a little lower, like Moses Moody, who's more of like he's like a 3-and-D kind of win with some ball skills, but he's a really good decision maker, can make some passes off of advantages. Franz Wagner is a guy who's probably not going to go that high, but can dribble a little bit, is more kind of in the Love and Nance mold. If you don't want him like dribbling a lot, but he's a pretty good passer and a wonderful, wonderful defender.
What do you think about Scotty?
I'm not really a Scotty guy, and I'm definitely not a Scotty guy with like Isaac Okoro already there. He's bigger than Okoro, but he is such a non-athlete in the sense that he doesn't really have any burst, any He's got some size, but he's not super strong. Like, he can overwhelm guys with size, whereas Okoro isn't big, but he's like, right, he's super strong. That's where he can do things. And he's pretty like quick off the ground to an extent too. Barnes doesn't really have any sort of vertical leaping either. So I think he's a fine, like maybe a mid lottery, late lottery, early teens guy, but I don't like him probably as high as the casual draft. And I don't like him, especially with what we've seen from Okoro. I think Okoro is kind of the one, I don't want to call him a non-shooter, but the one poor shooter who can still be a really good player, even if the jumper doesn't quite come around. I don't want to try and build around or build with two of those guys.
Well, remember, the Cavs are tied for fourth with like nine teams, so they could be picking eight or nine if things break wrong.
Yeah, but I think there are enough options that are plus shooters or just shooters in general that make more sense there. But I get the appeal of Scotty, but I think Okoro shown enough that you probably don't want to have three of your core five guys being non to poor shooters with Allen, Okoro, and Scotty Barnes in this case.
That's a fair point. Like I'm kind of become enamored with Scotty Barnes, but I think the concerns you're raising are incredibly valid. I just like on the defensive end, I love the potential, like those two being the stoppers. The Cavs haven't really had a forward tandem like that on the defensive end, and that's something that I would find refreshing. I like his passing, but I think the concerns about athleticism, the outside shooting, especially if a Okoro shot does still need more time, that's going to come up in a hurry. And Moses Moody, I'm glad you mentioned him, because he's been the guy in my mind that I'm like, worst case scenario, if you fall, you're probably going to have a good shot of picking Moses Moody, which I think he'd be a really great fit with the Cavs. One guy you didn't mention that I'd like to ask about is Kuminga. I've seen him in tier two for some people. I've seen him in tier three. Where does he kind of fall, and what would your read be of how he would fit with the Cavs?
Yeah, he's a guy I'm not huge on. I think he's just got a lot of kind of gaps to fill in this game that it's like, yeah, if these all come together, he'd be really intriguing at his size and kind of his fluidity. But I struggle to see all of them coming together. Like he's a pretty poor decision maker right now. The jumper has never really been there for him, even though he's kind of taken some jumpers, like the free throw percentage, the mechanics have never really aligned at all. And I've kind of grown doing draft stuff, I've kind of learned that there's more to it than free throw shooting, but I don't think his mechanics are great either. So the decision making, the defense is pretty porous too. Like he can do some stuff defensively, like at times he knows how to make rotations, but he doesn't know how to position himself. Like he'll make an interior rotation, but his hips will go all right into the guy when he tries to stay vertical. So and then he's got some interior passing. Like he kind of has a nice little post game, which is cool, and he can kind of wrap passes around to guys. But just with the decision making and the general defensive awareness and execution and the questionable jumper, I just think there are too many things there for me. And then he's not super bursty either. Like he's got very good strength for his size. It can do a little, but that, and then his handle isn't great. So there's just a lot of worries. Like I see the vision. I see this 6'8", 6'9", guy who can attack from the perimeter, can post up, can make reads. But I think he's a long ways off from that actually being who he is. And I just think there are too many boxes he would have to check to get there. And I don't think all of it is low. I think a lot of it would be tough to rectify or improve quickly. So
it feels like he's the kind of guy who would have gotten really high in last year's draft. It's like, well, we don't have like a tier one talent here, so like, let's take a shot at a tier one talent. Even if it might take a while to get there. Like this year, it just feels like you got so many options as compared.
Yeah.
Where
yeah,
you can say, sure, oh, I might get a super duper star here. So like, I'm not in a big hurry to take a guy like Kuminga.
Yeah, and I think he deserves to go lottery. I don't know how high, but I would definitely shy away from him anywhere in the top, I don't know, seven or eight. Again, I don't know exactly where I'd put it, but just too many things that he has to overcome and whatnot. But I do think, you know, if it comes together, it would be cool. And he's got a wonderful story too, you know, of everything. So by no means am I, you know, rooting against him or, you know, counting him out, but
That's what I heard.
Yeah. Word on the street.
That's actually going to be the headline of the pod.
Yeah. Jackson Frank hates Kuminga.
That's a terrible gonna be YouTube title, but we'll see how it goes.
One question. So for me, when it comes to drafting, you kind of the approach that I always have is you have your tiers, and then within each tier, you kind of make a decision on who you feel most confident in your ability to develop them, both by kind of situation, the roster that you have. Because I think where someone gets drafted often kind of dictates how good they are, especially early on in those formative years. Let's say from the tier three side of things. So the top guys are kind of off the board and the Cavs have to look at the options. Obviously, Moody is someone that's come up. Is there a name that hasn't been mentioned that you think really would excel in the Cavs roster?
That's an interesting question, because, yes, I think context is such a huge part of it, of development. I mean, even if you just want to talk about players, I mean, look at a guy like Bobby Portis having a great year on a team. I mean, I think a guy who makes sense that maybe if you're getting into tier three or maybe kind of the start of tier four, Corey Kispert makes a ton of sense. I would stay a little bit away from him top 10, but I think if they would trade down or something goes wrong, maybe they trade, you know, let's say they trade Larry Nance on draft day or whatever, and they have like the 15th pick. I don't want to get into that, but I think there's
just a shot to the gut here and the heart.
But I think Corey Kispert is a guy who, back into the lottery again, I'm not taking top 10 quite. I think there are too many concerns and you're kind of shooting for I think he's really interesting. I think he can amplify a team, but I think he does make some sense in that 9 to 15 range. Again, that's probably not where the Cavs will be drafting, but with the shooting, he's a good team defender. He can attack closeouts. He's a very good finisher too.
He can buy a round of beers for the other rookies, you know?
Yeah, exactly. He can take Isaac Okoro out for his 21st birthday next year.
Rent a car, you know, it'd be great.
I get the concerns with him. And I think, but what I would say too is, if a full disclosure, like Isaac Gonzaga, there's probably some, you know, some bias for me there, but I do think
he's buried the lead, my friend. I can't believe you have Suggs in front of Green or Green in front of Suggs. That's
yeah,
amazing.
That's the thing is I gotta balance things out. But I do think with Kispert, he's, you know, if people are gonna point, okay, like Obi Toppin struggling this year, but Kispert has played a role that I think is more reflective of what he can do in the NBA. Like, he's been on kind of different teams. He's been a secondary guy. He was kind of the man this year on that good team, but. I think with Toppin, if you want, I'm maybe rambling a little bit here, but with Toppin, like, he's had to kind of totally transform how he impacts the game offensively. But with Kispert, I think it's fairly straightforward. Like, you're going to spot up, we're going to run you off threes, you're going to attack closeouts, you're going to be a good team defender. There's not really an adjustment there. So he's a guy that I think makes some sense, but it's just tough because this is kind of a fairly guard heavy kind of contingent of players in draft class. And I think, I don't really want to go with a guy who's 6'4" or under for this Cavs roster right now. And you don't want to draft for fit, but I think there's a lot of close guys that in terms of caliber of prospects that I think, you know, like, I don't want to go with a Jaden Springer or a James Booknight, because I don't necessarily think they are super necessary. But you could also go Keon Johnson. He's an interesting guy, kind of an athletic, you know, really, really good defender, kind of needs to improve his jumper, but really athletic and get to the rim, attacking off the closeouts. But, I don't think there are a lot of great options once you kind of venture outside the top 7 or 8 for Cleveland, but I think luckily for them, they probably won't be doing that at least. So
fingers crossed.
Yeah.
would Suggs be the one exception? So he's a 6'4" guard, obviously. It would be a little awkward. I think
let's say they get the fourth pick.
Green's off the board.
Green's off the board. Mobley's off the board. Cade's off the board. What do you do?
Yeah. That's tough. I don't like that. I probably resign in my hypothetical role as Cavs GM here. Or Cavs
wow.
But
clearly didn't want that job that much.
You take some phone calls for a trade back potentially.
Yeah, of course. But yeah, I think I would go Suggs, but you know, a guy that, you know, I haven't really mentioned who seems to kind of be rising up boards, who I have watched some of, but I've also just heard a lot of good things about him is Josh Giddey. I don't know if he'd go 4, but he's playing the NBL right now, obviously the same league that LaMelo played in. By no means is he a LaMelo caliber prospect, but he's a really, really good playmaker at 6'8". Knows how to play defense, but in similar to LaMelo, he just chooses not to a lot. When LaMelo has learned how to play, he's been better this year. But kind of that similar jumbo playmaker who can, you know, make reads over the top. The jumper is by no means broken. You see some pretty impressive flashes. So I think there's a lot there, just a really smart, instinctual player. Kind of a nothing athlete, but again, he's got the size and the craft, and so he's someone I would consider. But I think I would go Jalen Suggs, but I would not envy the Cavs front office if they had to go there.
it would certainly make things awkward. Like, I think you could stagger guys around that you could still get 30 minutes, but I think you have an easier time going with a bigger guard. Play more on the wing.
It certainly expedites probably moving one of the three, you know, that you're starting to move into that territory at that point where it's like, okay, we can't be built around three guards that are 6'2". Like, you just, like, come on, you're just not doing that.
Hey, he's at least 6'4", I think.
Yeah, he's 6'4". But
he's going to be, I promise you, he comes out at 6'3" after the combine. Yeah.
I think Garland got 6'4" at one point. I think I saw him on one mock draft at 6'4". I'm like, hey, you know what? That's a pretty big point guard. And then you just see him and you're like, no, that guy's 6'1".
Someone on his side was pulling some strings in that mock draft for sure. Yeah. So
he was wearing platform shoes.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, if the Cavs get to four and they feel like Suggs is clearly their guy, by all means, yes, do it. But if they get to four and they're like, yeah, I think Suggs is the best guy here, but we also like Moody, or we like Franz, or we like Josh Giddey, we like, you know, any number of guys, definitely kind of prioritizing them, because I think Garland and Sexton have shown enough to kind of be core players of your future. And I wouldn't want to, you know, again, I don't want to draft, you want to go best player available when you can, but I think you'd be really putting yourself in a tough spot if you went with three. Six, we'll say 6'3.5" for an underguard. We'll split the difference there.
I think that's fair. And that's one of those situations where I'm glad I'm not the one making the decision. Like, I'm pretty open. And you know what? I appreciate this about you, Jackson. You have acknowledged your bias multiple times on this podcast, and that is really keeping with the spirit of what we do here. So I appreciate that. But like, for me, I don't watch college basketball. Like, I have to be honest. Like, I do not have the bandwidth to watch it. So that's why we value having people like you come on the podcast and kind of give us some analysis.
Do our work for us.
But and I will develop very strong takes on who they should take, but at the same time, I'm acknowledging that this is all coming from secondhand stuff. And at the end of the day, like, it just, hey, I've been wrong a million times before. I hated the Sexton pick, and it's worked out that he's justified being picked at that spot. So you know what? You never know how this is going to play out. But we really do appreciate the perspective that you brought to this podcast and the knowledge, because at the end of the day, we are just a couple of gas bags and don't do the homework that you do.
Well, I appreciate the two of you having me on. It's been fun talking basketball. And I can say, I don't always enjoy watching college basketball either. It can be a slog, but it is worthwhile to at least be the conduit of information for people who can't tolerate it at all. So
it's tough.
What a professional.
It's real tough. Well,
the NBA, on the other hand, I do always enjoy that. Let's be clear. I can always get behind that. So I appreciate you guys having me on, and always welcome to, or always happy to shine a light on the college basketball side of things.
Well, we really appreciate your time, and make sure for all of our listeners that you're following him on Twitter at @JackFrank_JJF. You can also check him out at Dime Up Rocks, at The Analyst, at Liberty Ballers, and you just follow him on Twitter. That's the easiest way.
Yeah, I've got so many places where my fingerprints are. So at this point, yeah, whenever I go on pods, I'm like, just if you want to find my work, just go to Twitter. I'm not going to list out every place where my work is present in one way or another.
The prolific Jackson Frank, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for your time. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe. It's the best way to help us show up on those algorithms. If you're listening via podcast, make sure you leave a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help cook those books. If you want to be part of Chasedown's exclusive Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. However you choose to support us, we really do appreciate it. Make sure you guys are staying safe out there, and until next time, go Cavs.